My name is Chuck Wells, and I'd like to welcome you to the session 32, which is entitled Air Pollution Control, Where We Are and Where We're Going. The session this afternoon will consist of five papers. We'll spend roughly 30 minutes on each topic with a 15-minute oral presentation and a 15-minute question and answer period after each talk. I'd like for you to hold your questions until the formal presentation is completed, and we'll have a 15-minute period for discussion. The first paper this afternoon will be given by Rainey Bertrand of SO Research and Engineering in Linden, New Jersey. The title of the paper is A Five-Year R&D Plan for Air Pollution Instrumentation. Rainey?
Good afternoon. The important role played by measurement techniques in a large number of air pollution control activities has necessitated that the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the primary government responsibility at the federal level, have an integrated and far-reaching plan to assure the timely availability of the measurement techniques which will be required. The Environmental Protection Agency's predecessor, the National Air Pollution Control Administration, contracted with SO Research in late 1969 to act as an extension of their capability to develop a plan for air pollution measurement technique development, which would cover the five fiscal years, 1972 through 1977. This plan covers not only instrumentation, but all measurement techniques, be they analytical method development, the standardization of methods, as well as instruments, which will be required for an effective national program. This afternoon, I'd like to discuss with you two aspects of our work in this program. The first is to describe briefly the method that we have used in defining the elements of the plan. I'll go into this method mainly because it has showed the need for some measurement techniques which have not been appreciated. And secondly, I'd like to disclose for the first time in public some of the highlights of the plan. I'd like to talk about where the emphasis is going to be and what the magnitude of the plan now appears to be. I say highlights because the plan has not yet been approved by EPA. The plan has been approved through the working level of the Environmental Protection Agency, but it is now in the process of review by the Washington headquarters. So I'll go as far as I can in disclosing these general highlights and open it up for questions, which I'll try to answer. In putting this plan together, we have looked at a plan hierarchy consisting of five elements. The objective of the plan has been to provide the timely availability of those measurement techniques which would be needed in order to meet the legal commitments that the Air Quality Act puts on the federal government, the state, and the local governments. We have looked at a number of functions, which are the areas of measurement which will be required. We have talked about the goals which are required for each of these functions as determined by an analysis of the legislation. And we have finally reached the capability needs. The capability needs is what we must accomplish in order to have measurement techniques to support the goals. And finally, we have listed some 150 different tasks, different projects which the federal government will have to fund over the next 5 years to ensure that we have these techniques available as required. The total magnitude of this program, in order to meet the requirements of present legislation, nothing that may be anticipated, but just the requirements on the federal, state, and local governments, put forth in the Clean Air Act of 1967 and in the Clean Air Amendments of 1970 is currently estimated at over $50 million. We have shown a requirement in terms of fiscal year, which is slightly greater than some $17 million in 1973, tailing off thereafter towards 1 or 2 million in the 76 to 77 fiscal year period. The tailing off comes only from the fact that we are not projecting new legislation, but only current legislation on the requirements. The reason for the vast increase from the present 71 through 75 is that we are behind in this field. The legislation requirements and the administrative promulgations of the Environmental Protection Agency to accomplish clean air by 1974-75 requires that we really have a catch-up program in measurement technique development. This figure shows in a little more detail this hierarchy that I was trying to illustrate before. We have our objective to establish the measurement capability required, and we have divided for the purpose of the plan five different functional areas of measurement. Measurement of the ambient air quality level, air pollution monitoring, measurement of stationary source emissions, measurements of mobile source emissions, including both the automobile and the aircraft, those meteorological measurements which are required to support an effective air pollution episode prediction program, and the measurement of air pollution effects, the effects of air pollution on both health and materials. And you may be aware that the Clean Air Amendments of 1970 call for a vastly accelerated federal program to define the effects of air pollution. For each of these functional areas, we have defined, through an analysis of the legislation, a series of goals. What it is that we will be required to do. As an example, in the stationary source measurement area, we will be required to measure the emissions from stationary sources by control agencies to determine compliance with applicable emission standards. The legislation in the Clean Air Amendments of 1970 also requires that the owners and operators may be required to monitor their own emissions and maintain a record. This is two different types of measurements, at least in terms of what might be considered reasonable in order to accomplish the measurements that might be required. We have then, in developing the plan, looked at the strategies. In other words, how could we accomplish these various goals? In the stationary source area, we might make the measurements by manual techniques. We might use remote instrumentation that we'll be hearing more about this afternoon. So we have considered the various technologies or strategies that could be used to accomplish the measurement. And in so doing, have developed for each of these goals a series of capabilities needed. The capabilities needed, and I'll give you some examples in a moment, represent what it is that we must accomplish in order that we have the means at our disposal to meet these goals. And finally, by a consideration of the state of the art, where we are today in terms of commercial instruments, methods that are available and used by the states and local regions, and the ongoing research and development, we have translated each of these needs into a series of tasks that may be required. What it is that the Environmental Protection Agency should fund in order to accomplish the goals and hence establish the measurement capability required by legislation. These four functions, five functions, which we discussed, that we divided the plan into for convenience, ambient air quality level measurement, source measurement at both stationary and moving sources, those meteorological measurements to support episode prediction, and the measurements of the effects of air pollution. And looking at that $50 million that I described as being required to meet the requirements of current legislation, we see the following distribution and how this money is going to be divided between these five functional categories. We find that ambient air quality monitoring and moving source emission measurement, mostly the automobile, and mostly state inspection programs, each account for roughly 25% of the total plan funding requirements. The stationary source emission measurement area accounts for fully 40% of that program. This reflects the marked increase in emphasis on measuring emissions at the source, which came out of the Clean Air Amendments of 1970. As you're well aware, the federal government has already embarked on a program to designate performance standards for industries by classes. The first five industrial classes have been already promulgated in the last couple of weeks, and there are some additional 25 or 30 industries to be affected during the next 2 years. These emission standards provide that the emissions from new sources shall not exceed certain specified amounts. The states will also be faced with similar emission standards, which they must promulgate in order to implement their ambient air quality levels, so that industry can be expected to require a fair amount of measurement technology in order to determine the emissions from their facilities. These measurements cover the whole spectrum of different types of pollutants, and the measurement of a given pollutant at one industry is not necessarily the same as it is at another industry. So we must develop the techniques, we must check the techniques out over a wide variety of industries in order to determine what we have. The capabilities that are required in order to accomplish this stationary source emission measurement, and this is just an example of capability needs for one of the functional areas, were divided for the plan into five groups. We must come up with procedures for measurement. Once we have decided to measure SO2 from a sulfuric acid plant, where in the plant are we going to allow the measurement to be made in order to assume that it is representative of the emissions from that facility? What calibration procedures must go with it? We must develop a series of manual methods of analysis that could be used for spot compliance and as the first backup method, the first set of interim techniques for making measurements. We must develop continuous instrumentation to measure these emissions. Without continuous instrumentation, it is doubtful that the need to monitor emissions by industry could be considered to be reasonable. If you have to take a grab sample and bring it back for analysis and find out the answer the next day, this may not be a legal, reasonable method to make your emission measurement. Remote measurements have been considered, and a series of support projects required to support and provide basic data for the entire source measurement area. We have also divided the plan into a number of activities: research, development, test and evaluation, all of which are well known. We've also included a category called collaborative testing. Once the hardware has been developed and it is tested and evaluated to see that it is suitable, most of this testing and evaluation is done by experts, people in the laboratories with fairly high degrees of skill. Unfortunately, in many cases, with a nationwide air pollution monitoring and control program, it will be necessary for people to make these measurements, to use these test procedures, who do not have these levels of skill. So the collaborative test program is meant to ensure that once we have a method that has been checked out and found valid by experts, that these same methods are checked by representative users, be they in the control agencies, in the government, in industry, to assure us that they get the results that they should with that test, and to maintain an effective quality control check program so that any measurements which are made by control agencies can hold up in court. And finally, we have the whole matter of promulgation. How do we get these methods, now that we have them, out as official methods approved by the various groups like the Inter-Society Committee, the ASTM, the states, and the federal government to form an official national standard method for making the measurement? In putting together the resources required for the plan, we find that the amount to be spent for research and development is a relatively small portion compared to the testing, the evaluation, the collaborative testing, and the promulgation. We are relying to a great extent on help from the private sector of the industry, at least in the stationary source measurement area, for which we anticipate a fairly large market for instruments. The federal research and development money, to a great extent, is going into the ambient air quality monitoring area to provide methods to measure trace pollutants for which standards do not currently exist, but for which we need information to determine their effects on health and welfare and to decide if emission standards as well as ambient air quality standards must be established. And finally, I'd like to give you some idea of how the various pollutants comprise this total $50 million of funding. You will see that the pollutants, which are usually emitted in combustion from stationary sources, sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, particulates, including visibility, hydrocarbons, and odors, not only stationary sources but also mobile sources, but from combustion primarily, account for perhaps 70% of the total instrumentation and methods development dollars required. The hazardous agents, of which we have heard a great deal in the last year because of their inclusion as specific categories in the legislation, these include things like mercury, asbestos, don't require that much in the way of dollars in order to develop the measurement techniques. And the other pollutants make up the remaining perhaps 20% of the program. In short, we have provided a plan covering the next 5 years of effort by the Environmental Protection Agency, which details these requirements in some 150 different tasks, each of which having the various activities that we mentioned, covering these various pollutants to provide the methods required to enable this nation to mount an effective program on air pollution control. I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can. Are there any questions? Chuck?
Now, could you give us an indication of when the EPA may approve the recommendations for instrumentation funding?
I suspect they'll be approved perhaps within the next 3 to 6 months. The main emphasis on this program now, of course, is in preparing their detailed plans for the 1973 fiscal year, which starts next July. And so the approval will have to come before that date, sometime around the end of the year, perhaps. '71 was about $4.5 million, Bill. 72 is perhaps closer to, it's planned for something in the order of about $7 million. We're requesting that for 72, in order to obtain these instruments in a timely period, we should have something like about $8 or $9 million. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I did not hear you.
How you determine the relationship between the air quality standard and emission control standard?
Well, this is something we did not do in the plan. This is something that various parts of the Environmental Protection Agency have done. They have set up certain emission levels from various industries in the hopes that this would be sufficient to meet the ambient air quality standards which have been set. In many cases, these emission standards have been based on the best available technology. This was an area that we did not have any part in this particular work.
I have a general question. Is there a plan that EPA plans to propose to do some kind of archiving of all the data that's being taken or hopes to be taken in the next 5 years or so?
This is data on the levels of air pollution in different places. I'm afraid you're asking the wrong person that question. I can't speak for EPA in that regard. I appreciate the problem that you mentioned. There has been a lot of data collected in the past. What we've addressed ourselves to in this plan is getting data which is required on a day-by-day basis in order to enforce the plan, not collecting data for the sense of being able to make long-term measurements. These are the tools which will be required by the control agencies to effectively police and enforce an air pollution control program. Question over there? Thank you.
Do you have any idea of the yearly expenditure by industry in the development of instruments?
No, I don't, Bill.
Our next speaker is Dr. Feldstein from the Bay Area Air Pollution Control District. His talk is on measurement and control of regional air quality, in particular referencing the work that is presently being done in the Bay Area. Dr. Feldstein.
Thank you very much, Chuck. I would like to, in the few moments I have, present a summary of where we are in terms of air monitoring, one of the aspects that was discussed by the previous speaker. And I would like to mention at the outset that EPA may be talking about the next 5 years in developing data. We have been developing it for 15 years. And we have a bank of data, which is available through the State Air Resources Board. And the comment is made to indicate that while the federal interest is relatively new in air pollution monitoring, in California it's been going on for many years, 25 years in the Los Angeles area and 15 years in our own area. The basic requirement for instrumentation is determined by air quality standards. And if we could have a look at that first transparency, I would like to briefly summarize some of the air quality standards which we're concerned with, because they determine the limits needed by instrumentation in an air monitoring program. Now, for example, the oxidant standard, and incidentally, I'm talking about California standards, and we do have some conflict between California and federal standards, which we'll point out a little bit later. The oxidant standard says that the air quality for oxidants shall not exceed a tenth of a part per million averaged over a one-hour period. And the purpose of a standard, of course, is twofold. The first is to prevent health effects in the most sensitive individuals exposed to levels of these contaminants over the duration of time. And the second is to take the necessary control action so that those emissions which contribute to the air quality standard will be reduced and the air quality standard will be met. Carbon monoxide, there are two air quality standards, one with an averaging period of 12 hours, which states that it should not exceed 10 parts per million over this period, and a one-hour standard, which states that 40 parts per million should not be exceeded in that period of time. Similarly, we can look at sulfur dioxide and particulate matter, visibility-reducing particles, nitrogen dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, and lead, all of which carry with them specific numbers over definite averaging times in order to meet the air quality standard. And these levels and the averaging times for which they are set determine the sensitivity required by instrumentation. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that there are some differences between California air quality standards and federal standards. And in some cases, the federal standards are more stringent. In other cases, the California standards are more stringent. Our latest interpretation indicates that if a state has more stringent standards than the federal government, it can enforce those standards, whereas the reverse is not true. I'd like to comment only on one of these comparisons, looking at the oxidant. The federal standard calls for 0.08 parts per million averaged over an hour. The California standard calls for a tenth of a part per million. And I think there's some interesting points to make about this. First, is there really a difference between 0.08 parts per million and 0.10 parts per million based upon our current available instrumentation? And secondly, one would have to look at natural background, which may occur in various areas of oxidant. For example, we have experienced in the Bay Area, and many other areas have experienced, levels as high as 0.2 of a part per million due to lightning storms. And I don't think that the purpose of air quality standards is to outlaw lightning storms. So these are some of the problems that we must evaluate in terms of the levels which have been set and the requirements for instrumentation. Now, I think, again, in looking at instrumental requirements, we ought to have some concept of the concentration range one might expect in the atmosphere. And I've listed here a few of the compounds that we're concerned with currently in our monitoring programs. For example, ozone may range from 0 to 0.8 of a part per million. In the Los Angeles area, values of 0.8 of a part per million have been experienced. Nitrogen dioxide from 0 to 1 part per million. And so on down the list, nitric oxide, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, 1.5 parts to about 15 parts per million. Hydrogen sulfide, 0 to 1 part per million. So these are the parameters that determine the sensitivity of instrumentation which will be used to monitor for these contaminants. Another problem which is very important in air quality monitoring is the location of a monitor. If one wishes to meet air quality standards in a particular area and one does not have any guidelines as to the location of instrumentation, I can conceive of meeting all air quality standards very readily by putting a sampler on the top of Mount Tamalpais. And air quality levels will generally be quite good there. But in the Bay Area, perhaps we've taken a little bit more realistic approach, and we've operated in the 9 counties a series of air quality stations, air quality measuring stations, which range from complete stations, indicated by the green dots, which monitor for all the primary contaminants, to partial stations, which monitor for 1 or 2 of the contaminants of interest. And our network is designed in terms of meteorological exposure, in terms of community exposure. It is our feeling that an air quality monitoring network, a station should be located where there are large numbers of people who are exposed to ambient levels of air pollutants. And so this is the kind of a network that has to be developed in many areas where there presently are no measurements being made. Another point I think that might be of interest to mention is what the air quality is in the Bay Area relative to the standards of the state of California. Where do we stand now in terms of air quality? How much more work do we have to do on controlling emissions which give us excesses in air quality? Well, one may look at the oxidant and note that in 1970 this standard was exceeded on 106 days in the Bay Area. For carbon monoxide, the record is much better, 5 days in excess of the standard. Sulfur dioxide, about 18 days. Particulate matter, a 60 microgram per cubic meter annual geometric mean requirement. The range in the Bay Area runs from 51 to 73 micrograms per cubic meter. Not too much above the state standard of 60 micrograms. These are the measurements that have been made over the 1970 season, and hopefully with improvement in control technology, particularly from automobile exhaust, which accounts for a fair percentage of pollutants, these values will decrease. I couldn't help but note from the previous speaker's talk that very little effort is being expended in terms of the EPA proposal which is being made on some of the problems which are much more important in California than others. For example, oxidant. I think it was the narrowest pie in that narrowest piece of pie in the whole section. And yet in California, the oxidant problem is the major air pollution problem. We're very fortunate in California in that most of our energy development by thermal systems is developed with natural gas. And so the sulfur dioxide problem is a relatively minor problem in California, except in areas of high usage of sulfur recovery, sulfuric acid manufacture associated with refinery operations. But generally speaking, the sources are local sources, and they do not contribute to air quality degradation except in the immediate vicinity of the source. Our main concern is with the photochemical process that goes on under California sunshine and under California inversions to produce from primary reactants, nitrogen oxides and hydrocarbons, ozone amongst other things, and a wide variety of other materials which give us some of the symptoms of eye irritation, visibility reduction, and vegetation damage. And I've indicated some of the reactions which we've begun to unravel to elucidate some of the mechanisms involved in this kind of air pollution. As a consequence, most of our activity in monitoring is concerned with measuring these contaminants. Now, to complicate the picture a little bit in terms of the requirement of an instrument, if we look at the daily pattern of formation and disappearance of each of these contaminants, we see that they follow certain very regular patterns. The nitric oxide emitted from combustion sources is high in the early morning hours. It falls off, and as it falls off, the nitrogen dioxide builds up. After the nitrogen dioxide peaks, the ozone begins to form, or oxidant, formaldehyde begins to form, the peroxyacetyl nitrates begin to form. So you have a very complex mixture of chemical substances in the atmosphere due to photochemistry, and any instrument designed to measure a specific substance must of necessity take these kinds of interferences into account. Now, briefly, I would like to summarize some of the current instruments available for monitoring some of the pollutants that we are concerned with in this area. Oxidant, as I mentioned, being our primary concern, there are generally available two types of instrumentation which are being used at the present time. And by being used, I mean which have been used in monitoring stations for 5 to 10 to 15 years based on chemical systems, reaction with potassium iodide, and either colorimetric measurement or coulometric measurement. And the sensitivity of these instruments, lower limit down to about 1/100th of a part per million. Fairly adequate for measuring levels in the air quality standard range, which is 1/10th of a part per million. And similarly for nitrogen oxides, based again upon wet chemical systems, reaction between NO2 and an azo dye to form colors, and the colors then read photometrically, and a sensitivity here down about 0.02 parts per million. Sulfur dioxide analyzers, three types generally available: coulometric measurements, conductometric measurements, and colorimetric measurements. All kind of mock-up models from laboratory determinations of this particular gas. And I think this is one of the criticisms that we have in terms of these types of instruments. They were designed by following some of the requirements of laboratory methods of analysis and have been scaled up into automated wet chemical systems. And as such, they suffer from a number of deficiencies, which we'll look at when we look at some of the more specific details of the instrumentation. Now, for oxidant monitoring, as we mentioned, we generally have two types of instruments, both wet chemical systems. One based on the oxidation of iodide to iodine, which is read photometrically, and the other an amperometric measurement on a particular type of ion sensing device. Ozone formation we have discussed briefly in terms of the photochemical reaction that takes place in the atmosphere, and this accounts for the presence of ozone, which is a secondary contaminant. There are very few sources in any area which emit ozone, but as we saw earlier, levels as high as 0.8 parts per million have been measured in the Los Angeles atmosphere. There are some interferences with this wet chemical procedure, whether it be amperometric or coulometric, and that includes the fact that the reagent, potassium iodide, responds to oxidizing agents. Ozone is present to about 85% to 90% in this mixture, but nitrogen dioxide is an oxidizing agent. And nitrogen dioxide appears as ozone in this type of measurement. Similarly, sulfur dioxide, being a reducing agent, tends to oxidize the iodine which is formed in this reaction, and so we get a negative effect. We have learned how to remove sulfur dioxide interference by developing scrubbers which will oxidize the SO2 coming into the gas stream, but unfortunately we have not yet been able to remove the nitrogen dioxide without also removing the ozone. This schematically shows the typical structure of a wet chemical system. And it's common for the oxidant analyzer, the NO analyzer, the NO2 analyzer, even the SO2 analyzer. Essentially, we have an air sample coming in one direction, a reagent sample coming in another direction, mixing in some kind of contact column, the reaction taking place on the contact column, and the reaction product passing through another leg of a photometer so that using a ratio photometer, we get a difference in the intensity of incoming solution versus outgoing solution, which is current is then magnified and sent to a recorder. And this is the basis, with some modifications and some changes, of most of the wet colorimetric systems that we're familiar with, including the oxidant. The only recent development, and here again I must emphasize that when I say recent development, I'm talking about instruments which have been used and proved in the field for about 5 to 10 years, is the oxidant analyzer based on the same chemical reaction, but now instead of measuring the color formed in the ozone potassium iodide reaction, we measure a redox potential and we can measure the actual flow of current. But it's a similar type of instrument with a solution pump forcing solution down the contacting column and an air pump forcing air through the reaction taking place on this platinum-wound contact column and the current developed, which is then amplified and measured. Nitrogen dioxide, as I mentioned, is a wet chemical system. We take advantage of the fact that NO2 can react with an organic amine and diazotize it. A coupling agent in the solution is present and the diazotized compound is coupled and we get a dye. And the same kind of process that went on with the oxidant takes place in NO2 and NO analysis. Interferences occur in the presence of sulfur dioxide. SO2 bleaches the color formed, and so we are sometimes in high SO2 areas not measuring the specific wavelength of the azo dye which is formed. Ozone also, being an oxidizing agent, tends to oxidize the color which is formed, and we do not get a true representation of what the particular NO2 level would be. For NO, nitric oxide, while we are more concerned with nitrogen dioxide, NO is the precursor of nitrogen dioxide. All of the nitrogen oxides of concern are emitted from combustion sources as nitric oxide. We have adapted the same system for measuring NO2 by taking an airstream and passing the airstream through some kind of oxidizer which converts the NO to NO2, and then we pass through the same type of system and measure the formed NO2. One of the most recent breakthroughs has been the fact that we are now able to take an airstream and remove the NO2 from the NO-NO2 mixture and then specifically measure the NO by oxidation to NO2. Prior to this, we had to measure total nitrogen oxides and subtract the preformed NO2 from that measurement. But we're now able, by an adaptation of a chemical procedure, to remove NO2 and measure NO more specifically. There are some developments in NO analysis which are taking advantage of new principles, new methods of measurement, and we'll hear more about that from our other speakers. And I just wanted to measure one, a method for measuring NO by chemiluminescent techniques, which takes advantage of the fact that NO reacts with ozone to form nitrogen dioxide, and gives off energy. And this energy can be detected in a photomultiplier. So the system involves an ozone generator, an air sample, a reaction cell, a filter, a photomultiplier to measure the emitted radiation which is formed in the near-infrared region. There are other developments taking place in instrumentation, and these I think will be spoken about a little bit more in detail later. Sulfur dioxide, which is of such concern in some of the high sulfur fuel burning areas and is of concern in relatively few areas, have been monitored for many years. There's a long history of sulfur dioxide monitoring. Remembering the air quality standard for the state of California, 0.04 parts per million averaged over 24 hours, we can see that the sensitivity required is quite high for such an instrument. Fortunately, there are available today both conductivity-type measurements, which take advantage of the oxidation of SO2 to sulfate and measure the increased conductivity by the presence of this ion, or coulometric techniques, which oxidize SO2 with bromine, continuously regenerating bromine, and the regenerating current is a function of the amount of SO2 which is oxidized. There are some interferences with SO2 measurement. Chlorine, for example, forms chloride ion and interferes or gives you a more positive response in terms of the SO2 that might be present. We have been able to remove SO2 from air streams in order to make such instruments a little bit more specific for other sulfur compounds. Now, there are some problems associated with both conductivity and coulometric and colorimetric methods in terms of other substances present in the atmosphere. We mentioned chlorine. Nitrogen dioxide also tends to have an effect with certain types of instruments. Hydrochloric acid, of course, if present in sufficiently high concentrations, will interfere with some of the measurements. Hydrogen sulfide is primarily an interferent in those coulometric analyzers, which use bromine to oxidize sulfur compounds. So there are problems in terms of the specificity of the type of measurement which is being made. Now, one of the most satisfactory instruments that we have, and one which I think is the goal for the development of all instrumentation, is carbon monoxide analyzer. And it's satisfactory in the present generation of carbon monoxide instruments in that it measures a physical property of the material, the absorption in the infrared. And instruments have been developed and have been used for many years, which take advantage of this fact and provide a measurement of carbon monoxide based upon its absorption. Most of the systems currently in use make use of a sample cell and a comparison cell, and the difference in infrared energy passed by the two cells is detected, amplified, and recorded. There are some problems associated with carbon monoxide monitoring with this type of instrumentation, and that is that substances which absorb in the infrared tend to give you high results, such as water vapor and carbon dioxide. These can be removed by having scrubbing towers, removing moisture, or by using ascarite columns, which remove carbon dioxide, and so the measurement becomes more specific. One of the more difficult areas of monitoring is in the area of hydrocarbons. And I noted from the previous speaker that a fair percentage of that research money is going into hydrocarbon analysis. And I can't help but comment on the fact that hydrocarbons really are of very little concern except as precursors for the oxidant formation. And so the ozone, which is formed as a result of ozone, NO hydrocarbon reactions, is really the important parameter that we're looking for. And yet we feel, and there has been developed on the federal level, a standard for hydrocarbons. At the concentration of hydrocarbons experienced in the atmosphere, there has never been presented any evidence that they are health affecting. And all of the air quality standards which have been developed to date have been designed to prevent health effects. So it's a little hard to rationalize the need for a hydrocarbon analyzer in terms of meeting an air quality standard. However, we are quite interested in hydrocarbon analysis because it is one of the precursors of the oxidant formation in the atmosphere. Unfortunately, the reactivity of hydrocarbons in this photochemical cycle vary quite markedly. And as we can see, we're more concerned with those compounds which are reactive and can be of significance in a photochemical reaction. The present technique for measuring hydrocarbon concentrations of the atmosphere are based upon hydrogen flame ionization detectors, the same detector which you find at the end of a gas chromatograph. In this case, however, we make no separations of the compounds, but merely pass them through the flame detector where they are burned, ions produced, which are amplified, and a current is proportional to the amount of hydrocarbon which is burned. Unfortunately, this kind of measurement gives us a total hydrocarbon analysis. It doesn't tell us the nature of the hydrocarbons which are present. And as I mentioned earlier, we are more concerned with reactive organic compounds or hydrocarbons, such things as olefinic compounds, which rapidly catalyze the conversion of NO to NO2, which rapidly react with the ozone that's formed to form some of the byproducts. Even aromatics are of significance. But the paraffins, methane, is totally unreactive photochemically and happens to be the individual compound present in the atmosphere at the highest concentration of any of the organic compounds that we have experienced. Acetylene, too, is completely inert and may be measured in the technique by total flame ionization. The last substance that I want to talk about is particulate matter. And here I think the problem is even a little bit more confused. The air quality standards are based upon total mass measurement, the amount of suspended particulates present in the atmosphere as measured by a specific kind of instrument. And the instrument is a high-volume sampler, which is nothing more than a vacuum cleaner blower with a piece of filler paper in the end of it. And you weigh the filler paper before and after, and you get a weight, and knowing the volume, you calculate the suspended particulates. And the standard in California is 60 micrograms per cubic meter annual geometric mean, with no 24-hour value to exceed 100 micrograms. Well, one has to look at, first, the purpose of this standard, which presumably is to prevent health effects, and secondly, the contributions of suspended particulate matter, which range from natural backgrounds, including soil, sea salt, terpenoids from plants, industrial emissions, which of course we're concerned with, vehicular emissions, lead and carbon compounds, photochemical aerosol generated in the photochemical process, and finally, gases, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide, converted to sulfates and to nitrates, and which show up on the high-volume catch. So that we really don't have a very good idea of what this high-volume sampler, which is essentially the blower motor and a piece of filler paper on the head, is catching in terms of its relationship to those compounds which are of great interest to us. Another type of sampler for particulate matter is a paper tape sampler, which merely sucks a sample of air through a tube and deposits a dark stain on a piece of filter paper. The only reason I think this has been used for as long as it has been used, and it has been used for about 25 years now, is that it's very cheap and that it's automated. You can put it away somewhere and it automatically changes a piece of filter paper every 2 hours. The relationship of the measurement it makes to the suspended particulates is very nebulous at best. One of the best ways, of course, to determine suspended particulates is to do a size fractionation, and there are many devices available using impaction principles, the Anderson sampler, which will separate the dust which is present, the suspended dust which is present in the atmosphere, in terms of its particle size. And since we are more concerned with those particles which deposit in the lungs, we can get a much better idea of the submicron particles by measurements of this particular type. Now, in conclusion, I would like to point out that there are some things that we still have to develop, and hopefully the work that was discussed earlier and some of the work that will be discussed a little bit later will bring these developments to a head. We need second-generation instruments to replace our wet chemical systems for the measurement, at least in California, of oxidant, nitrogen oxides, and sulfur oxides. Instruments which could be based upon the measurement of physical properties of these particular substances. We need some more specific measurements, measurement type instruments, for the hydrocarbons, for example. We really want to know the percentage of the total hydrocarbon, which is olefinic, aromatic, aldehydes, because these are the ones which are of concern. And the importance here is that, after all, the purpose of monitoring these materials is to determine what the air quality is so that the necessary control action can be taken. If most of our hydrocarbon measurements show up as methane, we're not going to take any action against methane because it's photochemically unreactive. And so to get some logic into control, we need more specific hydrocarbon-type instrumentation. We need and will need instruments for other pollutants. For example, we've talked about 5 or 6 air quality standards, and these are just the beginning, as I understand it. There eventually will be air quality standards for some 30 or 40 different compounds. And to mention a few, polynuclear organics will have to be monitored. Lead will have to be monitored. Fluoride, beryllium, asbestos, and odorous compounds such as amines and mercaptans. At the present time, we are at the laboratory stage in measuring most of these kinds of compounds without any instrumentation available. And finally, in order to intelligently take control action, we have to develop more sophisticated instruments to measure physical properties of the atmosphere, such as the temperature structure, the presence of inversions, the height of an inversion, the intensity of an inversion. We have to measure visibility with methods of differentiating between visibility caused by the adsorption of moisture on submicron particles, the growth of submicron particles into the light scattering range, and so on. And finally, in order to take intelligent control action, we have to be able to measure ventilation in a basin and the dilution volume available for the dispersion of pollutants. With these kind of measurements, we can eventually determine more intelligently the kind of control action that's needed. Thank you very much.
Just a simple-minded chemistry question here. How does an olefin go about oxidizing nitric oxide to nitrogen dioxide? What is it itself reduced to?
It's a catalytic reaction. The hydrocarbon serves as a catalyst and is not used up. And the type of hydrocarbon in the conversion of NO to NO2 is a function of the chemical structure. The olefins are quite good at catalyzing the conversion of NO to NO2. Aromatics are good. Methane does not.
How do? They hold on to the oxygen while the NO comes up or something mm-hmm. like that? No. I can see an aldehyde with an oxygen giving up the oxygen there.
Well, it's a true catalytic reaction because the olefin is not used up in that reaction. It's a surface reaction.
Actually, hydrocarbon is kind of a misnomer for all those things with oxygen.
Yes, yes. It should be organic compounds or organic acids.
I was wondering about the calibration of some of this instrumentation. Do you use permeation tubes?
For those gases for which permeation tubes are available, like SO2 and H2S, yes. And it's a very convenient way of generating a known stream of these gases. For ozone, for example, we use a simple ozonizer, develop a stream of ozone, and then measure that concentration by a laboratory procedure in the airstream.
Do you expect future legislation to discriminate between particulate sizes so that instruments would be needed?
I think that this will have to come because this is a very important area in terms of looking at an air quality standard just by the number itself. For example, in the San Bernardino Desert, where there isn't a source of man-made air pollution within 100 miles, suspended particulates sometimes run as high as 250 micrograms per cubic meter, and it's wind-blown dust. So that, and it's all very high particle size because the wind carries higher particles at greater velocities. So I think that if we are concerned with health effects, which is the sole purpose of a standard, then we have to look at particle size distribution.
With respect to accuracy of these instruments, again, is there any national standard by which you can ascertain the accuracy? For example, does the National Bureau of Standards maintain standards? How are they calibrated, and how do you know when they're in and when they're out?
Well, this is really a problem, and I think our first speaker addressed himself to some of the problems that they're trying to resolve. In our own program, we maintain a constant calibration program whereby we generate known streams of these gases, either with permeation tubes or ozonizers, and continually check the performance of the instruments. We check our instruments on the average of 2 to 3 times a year in order to make certain that they are in the range that they're supposed to be. There are some problems about sensitivity. Many of the instruments being sold have not been checked. We have made it a general rule that we have an opportunity to check an instrument in our laboratory before we take it or purchase it and put it in the field. And many of the instruments, for example, for SO2 will not measure below a half part per million. And we're talking about a standard of 0.04 parts per million.
Could you comment on the response time required for these instruments?
Well, the response times, of course, I think is a function of the averaging time for the air quality standard. Now, it might be quite theoretically possible for Occident, for example, to have an integrating instrument which will only give you an integrated reading over a one-hour period. So that at the end of the hour, which is an hour's response time, you know whether or not you have exceeded the standard. Unfortunately, however, this would not be suitable in terms of looking at the rate of development of ozone or oxidant in the atmosphere, which is required when we talk about an alert system or an emergency episode warning system. So I think the instruments have to have a rapid response time, particularly so with sulfur dioxide instruments, where some of the ground level requirements state that a half part per million shall not be exceeded for 3 consecutive minutes. So this sets the lower limit of the kind of response that you need for this type of instrument.
The next topic of discussion this afternoon will be on physical methods of measuring pollutants. The next paper was written by Anders Jepsen, and the talk will be given by Lee Langan. It's entitled Correlation Spectroscopy and Its Applications to Remote Sensing of Environmental Air Quality.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't write the paper. So last night when Dr. Jepsen is away working, and he gave me a call last night and said he wouldn't be here, why don't you look at the slides and see what you can present and cover the same topic. So I did just exactly that. I went and looked at some slides that we've taken over the last 2 or 3 years and picked out what I think can tell a reasonably interesting story. For the last 3 or 3.5 years, we have attended ourselves to the problem of where we're going, and we're still going there. Mr. Feldstein talked about the where we are, and I think that all of the work that we've done are pointing new ways that we can go. Particularly, we've taken advantage of the physical measurements of various pollutants. And particularly, we have concentrated on a remote sensing type of instrumentation developed by a Canadian company, Behringer Research Limited. I'd like to show you some of the results that we've gotten over this period of time and some of the instrumentation. And I think it's worthy to note that we really fit in between the law today. Perhaps that's because the sort of instruments that we've been working with did not exist when the laws were being generated. But really, we aren't measuring in stacks, although we can measure in stacks. And we're not measuring ambient level, although we can measure ambient level. Where we find that we measure the most is looking at things from a macro scale, overall scale, and saying, where is the air pollution? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? These are the questions that we've tried to answer. I'll show you a few slides at first to describe the instruments and then some of the results we've gotten, please. Is there a button for... Oh, yeah. First slide. That's all right. Leave that there. This is a sketch of the correlation spectrometer, which is the instrument developed by Dr. Behringer. Basically, it measures a physical parameter, the molecular absorption of various gases. We've concentrated on two because they're two key gases. We've concentrated on sulfur dioxide, which is... I'll get all my tools here. The spectrum for sulfur dioxide is right here. This is a sketch of the spectrum in the ultraviolet range. Most work has been going on in the infrared. We've dealt with the ultraviolet here, and we make a mask, essentially, a photographic replica, although it's not exactly that, of the mask, and we disperse light, incoming light, from daylight. We don't necessarily use an artificial light, although we can. We simply use the scattered light from the sky overhead, and we bring that light in through a telescope, and it's bounced off of a mirror against a grating and thereby dispersed. And the dispersed light is shown on this mask. The mask or the light or the mirror, any one of these three components, can be moved back and forth, and the correlation of the light that's in phase with this mask is an indication of what the absorption is, and then you take it out of phase with the mask and there's no absorption. And I'll be glad to talk to anybody about the details of it, but essentially we can measure the quantity of the sulfur dioxide or the nitrogen dioxide in our field of view. That's important to think about that a moment. It's the quantity of the gas in the field of view, whether we're looking at a light at some distant point or whether we're looking at the sky overhead. We, as I say, are measuring SO2. Here the spectrum for iodine, which we've used as a reference on some occasions because it's easy to measure, and then for NO2 because it is a direct important air pollutant, although it is secondary. This is the state of development of the instrumentation. It's brand new, really. This is a dual gas, two gas instrument, although it's not necessary that you use both telescopes. One telescope, these are two Cassegrain telescope inputs. One is a very narrow beam or aperture so that we can look at a light at some point distant, maybe a mile, maybe 100 meters, maybe 5 miles, and let the air move the pollution between you and the light and simply divide by the distance, and you have the average concentration over this path. The other telescope is a broader band or broader scope, which we use generally for driving around and looking up. It's a rather small instrument. You see it's got a handle on it here. This is just a sighting telescope. It's an electronic instrument. There's no wet chemistry involved in it at all, and the record comes out, next slide. The record comes out on a strip chart. Here's simply a strip chart. Here we are down in Arizona looking at Tucson from a distant hill to see if there's any pollution. Well, a remarkably clean city that day, unfortunately, but nevertheless, we wanted to get into a clean area to get some baseline, so we went down there. This is the prototype of the instrument you've just seen. The instrument you've just seen has been available since March of 1971, and we're using it. Indeed, that's where Dr. Jepson is today. He's in Baltimore making measurements. This is the prototype that we've gathered very much of our data. It was a single gas instrument. It's mounted on its butt end here, looking up through a window up here in a microbus. And our standard mode of operation is to drive around an industrial facility, a smokestack, a city, a county, a state. We've driven from LA to San Francisco, for instance, and measure the amount of gas overhead. Now, there's some maps that I'll show you that we've plotted this. And this was the electronic case, and this is the prototype. Here's an example of a map in Washington, D.C., in which the heavy profiles here that are shown here are a profile of the gas directly overhead. In this particular case, it's sulfur dioxide. It's on a summer day, Bastille Day, 1970, in which we drove around the city of Washington, D.C., looking for sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide is invisible. It's in the ultraviolet. You cannot see it. The Potomac Electric Company has very clean stacks. They're remarkably clean, but they do spew out sulfur dioxide. And there happened to be three of them in Washington, one here in Alexandria, one here on Buzzard Point, and one up here. I've forgotten the name of the site. But at the same time we were driving around, we did have an SO2 monitor in the microbus. And so we measured ground level because, indeed, that's what it's all about. What do we breathe? It turns out that we breathe SO2 at this point. And indeed, everyone in Capitol Hill breathes SO2, and above the standards that were established by the EPA at that time, and at this time for that matter, we were measuring, as we drove around there, averages of 0.11 parts per million on the ground, and of course, able to show what we've sketched in here approximately is the distribution of the gas, and we were able to bring it right down to a single, or in this case, three stacks coming out of that. And we actually could then point the instrument at each individual stack and say that's the one that's putting out more and that's the one that's putting out less. Here's another example. I chose this because Mr. Ruckelhaus lived in Indianapolis. It's Indianapolis, and we drove across the United States with the vehicle last summer, and we drove in. This is a rather large regional map. It's 25 miles from this point to this point. We began to see the sulfur dioxide in this case on the highway as we drove into town of an evening on the 29th of July last year. Now I'll go to the bigger map. Again, all I've done is I've plotted as a profile, arbitrarily. This is just a profile laid on its side over the route of travel. And we drove in and we cut down on the freeway and ran out of the gas. So we turned around here and drove north, and there's a second little profile there. ran out of it and came over here and drove down and hit it again and then hit it a couple times here, and there was a power plant right there. I'd never been in Indianapolis, but that's where the principal source of sulfur dioxide is in the summer in Indianapolis. Here we are now with the instrument mounted in a microbus. This is the new two-gas instrument. We have right here simply a right-angle mirror, so again, we can look right straight up through the roof, and somebody sits back there and looks at the recorder and marks the where we are. We're measuring two gases simultaneously here. This is a plot of St. Louis, Missouri. Now, I want to tell you what we do with it besides just showing where the gas is. This is total burden in St. Louis, Missouri on the 11th of February, 1970. It's plotted as a in perspective, so it might not look exactly like St. Louis to you who are used to looking at St. Louis in maps. Here's the Missouri River, and here's the Mississippi River, and this is the boundary of the city of St. Louis. And this happens to be sulfur dioxide peaks or profiles as we drive along a route of travel. Here's the route of travel, kind of a complex route up there and so forth. So you see there's a lot of sulfur dioxide coming from someplace here. Actually, it's coming from Portage du Sault. And here's some more coming from this plant, and there's a little more. This is probably the same as that. But we looked at this map and we said, okay, that's nice, it tells you where it is, but what can you do about it? In the case of St. Louis, it's a nice flat area, and they publish each day a, what they call a transport wind, which is the average wind travel over the city of St. Louis beneath the inversion layer. And so we took this value and we multiplied it times the total burden, which is the total amount of gas overhead, and you can do that and you can plot the flow of gas. You can say how many tons a day are traveling over a route, or for that matter, how many tons a day are coming out of a stack which you've just crossed beneath. And here's the plot in tons per day. Each of these lines represents so many tons per day along a route of travel. It's a graphic representation. The lines begin along the route that we travel and then extend out the length of how many tons are going. This particular case says that the Portage du Sault power plant up here is putting out on the order of 1,200 tons per day of sulfur dioxide. And it's very much more than you see from anything in California, I can assure you. Give you an example, the total amount of SO2 flowing into Contra Costa County from all of the six refineries up there is on the order of 250 tons a day, something of this nature, all of them. And of course, there's a power plant right here which is spewing this out. This represents the gas by the time it gets from here down to here. It's a little bit broader and less flowing overhead. Here's another power plant, here's another power plant. Again, the power plants are the principal source of sulfur dioxide in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And that's under one set of wind conditions. Here we are under another set of wind conditions, about 30 miles an hour. You can see the same amount of gas is coming out of these various power plants, but it's coming out in a very linear stream. The same amount, but it's just a narrower flow, a narrower stream. Here is nitrogen dioxide in St. Louis. It's a much broader sort of a thing because there are many more sources. Not only is some certain amount of NO subsequently developed to NO2 coming out of the power plants, but it's also coming from all of the automobiles. So by the time you get downwind, you get a large regional buildup of nitrogen dioxide in an area. One would think that it might come from plants like this, but I had to throw this in. It looks terrible. It's all vapor. It's from the Budweiser plant, St. Louis. Smell good. In reality, it's coming from plants like this, which is a typical, this happens to be in Madison, Wisconsin, but it's a typical coal burning. You see the coal all snow covered here. Coal burning power generation station. Something of this size would put out a few hundred, maybe 500 tons a day of sulfur dioxide into the air. And where does it go? We've measured other places. This is our fair city of San Francisco. This is the photochemical smog that does indeed develop here, for those of you that are just visiting. We do have it. Mr. Feldstein's office right over here someplace. This is looking from across the city to the east of an early morning. The idea, everybody can look out their window and say, gee, yes, it's a smoggy day, and we better do something about it. What we're trying to do about it in a regional sense is to make maps. Now, here's a set of four maps taken a couple of years ago in which we drove around the San Francisco Bay Area. If you represent, now you can recognize the bay here. We drove on a freeway system all around the Bay Area down here, San Jose, and back up by Oakland and across the San Rafael Bridge into Marin County and then back into the city of San Francisco. It took about 3 hours to do this, 180-mile trip, actually. Again, looking vertically overhead at the amount of gas overhead, trying to quantize how much gas is there and where is it, at least at the time that you're beneath it. We don't have the freedom of a transport wind here to measure overhead, but because the ventilation of the gas, or rather the wind directions, are all very different because of the hills around us here. But nevertheless, this does give you a graphic picture of a smog episode, the way it's built up over 4 days. This is day one, day two. You can see it's beginning to build up all over the place in day two. This is day three with still wind, and it's built up in peaks all even higher than in the second day. Then on day three, the wind has become increased. It's up to around 15 miles an hour, and it's cleaned the city of San Francisco, basically, and blown the smog down into the South Bay. And this shows it in the South Bay, all blown up against the hills down in the South Bay. This is, again, not ground level NO2. We don't get good correlation with the ground level. But this, indeed, is how much NO2 there is on those days. Here we are again looking at the SO2 overhead. This happens to be at a smelter down in Arizona. The copper smelters provide most of the sulfur dioxide for the state of Arizona. Here again is the city of San Francisco. You'd think that people evacuated it because of the smog. That was just early one morning I got up. These are just some pictures of smog. Los Angeles, eastern part of Los Angeles around Pomona. You can see the layering that exists here. And indeed, when we make these total burden measurements, we look up through this whole cloud. We don't say that the smog exists on the ground or in the cloud or above the cloud, but we're measuring the whole thing. And it becomes particularly important if you see trends by making parallel traverses. Even New York City is known to have a certain amount of smog down the street canyons. Now, this is blurred on purpose. We do attend to making measurements with the correlation spectrometer at ambient level. And here's an example setting up, looking at this light, which is blurred in the distance here, about 300 meters away. There's the prototype equipment, simply viewing that light. We left it there for a couple of weeks. We've made these kind of tests in cooperation with Ms. Felstein at the Bay Area Air Pollution Control District. And again, it eliminates the metering, the amount of flow that goes through, and the chemistry. We simply let the wind blow the pollution by, and we get an integrated sample. You can set the lights up at any distance, any reasonable distance. We haven't gone much further than a mile or a mile and a half, but we have reason to believe you could go further. Actually, I think in some cases you might want to go that distance, but it might be more important if you made the measurements over a shorter distance and perhaps made more of them. It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to measure what the effect of an industry is, and you're trying to replace this kind of instrumentation with existing instrumentation, then you might use a shorter path. If you're trying to say what's happening over an entire city, you might use a longer path. Here's an example at the Bay Area, comparing in the dashed line here is the analyzers that the control district is using. And our results over a three-day period are in the solid line. So they compare reasonably well. One might say, why aren't they exactly the same? Well, there are two obvious reasons. One obvious reason is that one of them is lying, and the other obvious reason is that we're looking over a longer distance, and the offsetting effect may indeed be taking place someplace other than the point of their measurement. We've even flown around in airplanes with this, not the fanciest of installations, mind you, but it suffices. You can fly beneath a high stack and look up. Here's a right-angle mirror and a very fancy patch job on the side of a small Cessna. It gets the data. You can make the pollution emission measurement from the stack directly in that fashion. There is some clean air left back to Arizona. That's where we found most of the clean air, although I'm kidding, because it exists all over the United States. And it's one of the things I've observed about the air pollution business, and that is that when it's clean, you forget that it was once smoggy and once polluted. Industries can be clean. That's just vapor coming out of a gas-burning power plant in the San Francisco Bay Area. And last but not least, I think cities can be clean, including Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
When you take measurements vertically, how do you determine densities? What kind of distance do you use?
We don't worry about the distance. We measure the total burden, and our plot is in grams per square meter. That is the mass of gas over your head, over a square meter on the ground. If we're interested in plotting the flow of gas, you see, if you know all of the gas overhead and you know the rate of its movement, then you calculate how many grams per second.
Okay,
or
so
tons per day.
It's just a measurement then of how much is flowing overhead rather than...
How much is existing overhead. If, on the other hand, you look at a light at some distant point, you take your number and divide by the distance, and you come out with concentration. Our unit of measurement can be considered grams per square meter. It can also be thought of as parts per million meters. Along not knowing what the distance is, that's what it is. Sorry?
Have you done any studies of this detecting device inside of a long pipe in which pure and controlled impure gases, vapors, dust could be mixed in order to detect false and negative results and interferences with your measurement?
Yes, we've done a considerable amount of work on interferences, but not necessarily in a pipe, and I would welcome the opportunity to do it. We've done it in smokestacks. There is a version of the correlation spectrometer which has actually been fitted into a stack, an in-stack monitor, continuous on-stream monitor. And toward that goal, we've mixed in particles of various and sundry sizes. We've mixed in the other types of gases that you might come. Because you're correlating several lines in a given spectrum, if there's an interfering line, you simply block it out and forget it. And for that reason, you get a very high specificity. And we find that in general, the specificity is quite high and the interference is quite low.
I'd just like to mention a possible point of relevance. I thought your data and your constructs regarding St. Louis were particularly interesting. I'm sure that many of us are aware that there's about three times as much emphysema in St. Louis as there is in Winnipeg, Canada, amongst non-smokers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very relevant.
Well, I think that St. Louis has been an interesting study. It will be the subject of additional study over the next 3.5 years, or beginning about a half year from now. There's a major study in St. Louis, and we hope that's one of the places we're going to be going.
I've heard that the sources of SO2 in the east are due to heating of homes, and your data doesn't seem to indicate that. I noticed you did your work in the summer. If you do it in the winter, do you find that there's also a source?
Well, some of the results in St. Louis of sulfur dioxide are in the winter, in February. It was cold, I can assure you. The picture taken in Madison, Wisconsin was in the winter. And indeed, if you look at the maps carefully and you go downwind of the city, there's a general buildup in the city. There's certainly many more sources in the winter than there is in the summer. In the summer, because of the air conditioning, the principal source, without question, is the power industry. I might add, one of the things I didn't cover in here is that the way we calibrate. We simply place a vial of the known gas, or a vial, a little cell of gas, in the light path, and that gives us an offset on the recorder. We do this instead of once, well, we do it maybe every half hour or so, so we have almost a constant calibration.
I guess it was in the spring. I flew from Phoenix to, I guess it was on my way to Chicago, and I was quite disturbed to notice smog all the way at about 30,000 feet. I wonder if you ever used your instrument out of the window of a jet, and maybe this question should be answered by the previous speaker, but what happens to all these pollutants eventually? Where do they all go?
That's three questions, really. We've not measured out of the window of a jet. We welcome that opportunity. In general, we've made a lot of our measurements, and we're certainly measuring the gas overhead. It's up there. We can see it up there. But generally, the dispersion of the gas at those altitudes is so broad that when we're measuring, like on the San Francisco Bay Basin, it just becomes part of our background. The highest I've actually measured is on Independence Pass in Colorado, and that's what I considered my zero. It was clean. In fact, it rained before we made the measurement, so it was a reasonably clean day. But whether I was seeing some gas overhead or not, I still don't know. Where it goes, it generally impacts into the ground. Some of it travels around the world. Some of it stays, I imagine, for some time in suspension, but generally it's brought out by rain conditions. It's brought out of the sky. Ms. Chelsea might want to answer more of that.
Mel, could you use the speaker up there?
Generally, I think we're confusing the visible smog with what Dr. Lang is talking about. It's really invisible. He's looking at SO2 and NO2, both of which essentially are invisible. The smog is a very loosely defined term,
mm-hmm.
and generally consists of particulate matter. It so happens that at periods of buildup of visibility-reducing particles, it is true the NO2 and the SO2, if it's present, will build up. But I think we often get confused by saying we could see all the air pollution, and really what we're seeing is visibility restriction, which may be due in the Bay Area, for example, on a February cold day, salt nuclei in the atmosphere, and we wouldn't see any SO2 or NO2, but we'd have great visibility restriction. So I think we ought to keep those two parameters.
Yes, I think that's very important. That's one of the reasons for measuring the various individual pollutants, as opposed to simply looking out your window and taking a photograph. Yes. Okay.
There's one over here.
Did you contract with someone to do these studies?
Some of this work cities? Has been done under contract. Most of the work done under contract is private, really, particularly if it's under contract to private industry. They simply want to know what they're doing and where their smog is going. I use that word very generally, but where their pollution is going. We did, in cooperation with Washington University, the St. Louis data. We have, I'm trying to think of all the data I showed. I think the bulk of the data I've shown is under our own expense. As the conquistadores said, a su costa. This is one of the problems, you see. Where we're going depends on how much money is spent. And I was very interested in Dr. Bertrand's paper because hopefully there will be some money to be spent on these projects.
You mentioned two gases being monitored with your device. Do you have any limit as far as how many?
Yes, there are limits. This is physical chemistry, and some gases simply don't have absorption spectra. Some of them have absorption spectra that are not easily detected. We've concentrated principally on those gases that are important. That's why we were lucky that SO2 and NO2, two key gases, were available. Ozone is also possible. NO is also possible. CO is also possible. Reactive hydrocarbons are also possible. They exist in various portions of the ultraviolet, the visible, or the UV. One of the problems, for instance, with ozone is that we can measure it looking at a light at a distant point, or maybe not too distant. There's not enough energy sources, but you can get a distant measurement. But you can't go around driving looking overhead because there is the ozonosphere, which absorbs most of the light. So we don't have any energy to look at. So one of our techniques, long-line technique, is acceptable, but the other one, the total burden measurements, are not. Those are the kind of problems you run into. NO2 and SO2, it just so happens, have daylight windows, and you can see it, and it works. Thank you. Oops, another one.
What sort of light levels are required to do your measurements?
I can't give you a number on how many photons are needed, but I can say that in practice, we can measure NO2 in the daylight until the sun sets. And a little bit after sunset, there's still enough light. It's the Rayleigh scattering of the light that we're actually using. In the case of ultraviolet, the ultraviolet light sets earlier and rises later. So in the work we're doing this week in Baltimore, Maryland, for instance, we can go to work around 10 and quit around 4:30. That's kind of nice. But it does generate continuous data and one large volume of data, so you've got a lot of work to do at night by just reducing it, making maps. Yes.
There's some of us that might have rather serious interests. Approximately how much does the instrumentation required for mobile and stable measurements require? About how much money would it take?
Are you talking about a long continuous monitoring sort of thing? Or are you just saying to make a map?
Capital investment for original equipment would be about how much?
Well, those are dangerous. Those are hard questions to answer because it depends so much on the individual situation. I will say that to make maps on a periodic basis, not necessarily every day, but a periodic basis, to have a crew, to have a vehicle, to have the computer spew out the plotted maps and all this business is something on the order of $750 to $1,000 a day. If you want to buy the equipment outright, buy the correlation spectrometer, it's frightfully expensive, frankly. It's 10% more this week than it was 2 weeks ago because it's made in Canada. And the cost is, if you add a recorder and a little power inverter to drive around in the car with, and you put the spectrometer in it, it's $25,000. It's $19,000 FOB Toronto for the instrument. That's the two gas new instrument. So immediately you can divide by two. Thank you.